Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. Ali is away this week, so it's just going to be me bringing you up to speed with the week's most interesting political stories. Coming up, should the UK attempt to rejoin the EU customs union? That's the suggestion today from Lib Dem leader Ed Davey, who suggests doing so would boost the UK's economy. We'll also discuss whether we are a work-shy nation after the co-founder of beer brand and pub chain BrewDog suggested the UK is one of the world's least work-orientated countries. But is he right? And might that explain Britain's low productivity? As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
It's a very good afternoon because at long last, I can announce a ceasefire and a hostage deal has been reached between Israel and Hamas. More than 15 months of conflict that began with Hezbollah's brutal massacre on October the 7th. More than 15 months of terror for the hostages, their families, the Israeli people. More than 15 months of suffering by the innocent people of Gaza. Fighting in Gaza will stop. And soon the hostages will return home to their families.
Israel and Hamas have agreed a deal which would halt the war in Gaza and see the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners, the US and mediators of Qatar have said. It is the most significant breakthrough in 15 months of war, which began when the armed Palestinian group Hamas attacked Israel in October 2023. However, the health ministry in Gaza says dozens of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli strikes ahead of the deal between Hamas and Israel coming into force. Israel has accused Hamas of backtracking on the agreement, with a planned cabinet vote on the deal being pushed back. Netanyahu's office said the cabinet will not meet until the mediators, Qatar and the US, notify Israel that Hamas has accepted all the elements of the agreement. Hamas says it is committed to a deal, but the BBC is reporting that the group is attempting a last-minute push for the release of one or two symbolic prisoners from its movement. So, is the deal at risk of collapse already? Well, joining me this week to discuss this and some of the week's other major stories is the political correspondent Alicia Fitzgerald. Alicia, thank you for joining me. Okay, let's talk about this. Is the ceasefire deal at risk of breaking down already?
Well, obviously, we had that massive glimmer of hope because this is really the first time where we've heard that there's been any kind of agreement between the two sides. And it's kind of unanimously, globally been seen as a really, really positive step. But of course, this is such a complex conflict and it was never going to be really straightforward. As you said, the BBC are reporting that Hamas are actually trying to get two more of their symbolic prisoners released earlier on in the agreement. But there are also reports that actually the reason that Netanyahu might be delaying that cabinet meeting is actually more to do with disagreements within his cabinet than to do with Hamas. The issue there is that lots of the more right-wing members of the Israeli government are actually saying that, that this deal could actually give too many concessions to Hamas and to Gaza and not enough of a win for Israel. So all sorts of reports coming out at the moment. It's not 100% clear yet what's going to happen, but the US and the UK still seem pretty positive that, something's going to happen on Sunday.
Mm. And that does seem to have been the problem for Netanyahu throughout all this, is that he seems to be very much held back or perhaps bolstered by the right in his cabinet. Biden has said that his administration has been speaking as one team with the incoming administration of Donald Trump, who is obviously taking his role on Monday. There was a question in the press conference yesterday where they asked Biden if this particular ceasefire deal should be credited to Trump or Biden. And Biden made a bit of a joke about it and asked if the reporter was joking. Who do you think is responsible for this ceasefire deal? Do you think Biden should take the credit or do you think Trump should take the credit?
I mean, realistically, Biden, although we haven't heard much from him or seen much of him, you could be easily fooled into thinking he actually wasn't the current president of the US since that election in November. He has still been the person in charge and the person in power. and the person dealing with all kinds of foreign affairs and issues. That's not to say that Trump hasn't tried to make himself the front-facing statesman of the US, I suppose, and he definitely has kind of sped the process up in that transition of power. But realistically, it has been Biden who has been the US president from the beginning of this conflict and right until now. We're not quite at the inauguration yet. We've got that joy next week. So I do think it's probably slightly unfair for Trump to try and take all the credit for that when he's not actually in office yet.
Mm. Let's talk a bit about what this means for the UK, because we know that Labour particularly really felt the effects of the conflict in the Middle East during the general election and before that. What do you think the reaction will be in the party to today's news? And do you think this should be seen as a good thing for the government, or might this come back and haunt them?
I think Keir Starmer's response to this was interesting, and you could tell that he was really trying to be careful with his wording, because as much as he heralded this ceasefire deal, he still said that ultimately, whatever happens with this, it's not sustainable until there is a two-state solution, until there is a state of Palestine and Israel also. So he is making that point that even though this deal is good and it's progress, obviously, it needs to be something that's tenable for the future onwards. So you can tell that he's still a little bit anxious, as are the whole government and as is everyone involved, I suppose. I think realistically, in terms of how it impacts Labour, I mean, this has been something, as you said, that has pretty much plagued them for a while, particularly during the election process, losing MPs over their stance on Gaza. I mean, it has massively impacted them as a party, more so than other parties, more so than the Conservatives and all the smaller parties as well. So I think it will be a huge political relief for them as well to hopefully make some progress.
And if this ceasefire, I mean, obviously there is, decades, and in fact you could stretch it back further to say centuries of history to this conflict in the Middle East. But if a ceasefire were able to be maintained and there were broadly to be more peace in that region in the Middle East, do you think that Labour would still see the same kind of level of opposition from independent candidates at the next election or during local elections, for example, as they saw during the last general election?
Do you know what? I think given the political climate at the moment, I think that the topic of that opposition is slightly irrelevant. Obviously, Gaza was the huge issue at this election, but I think what we're seeing is a massive resurgence in smaller parties. I mean, we're seeing it with the growth of Reform, for example. People seem to be slightly interested in drawing away from the traditional two-party system and the people who they voted in before and maybe weren't impressed with or felt like they didn't really live up to their expectations. I think we're definitely seeing quite a lot of people in the UK look to move their vote to something different, maybe something a bit more radical, something that they just haven't tried and tested before. So I think even though the issue of Gaza, that might, hopefully, we can hope, go away, there will be something else, I think. Mm. I think it's just quite symbolic of the political climate across the country.
Well, from one difficult foreign issue to the next, it's been a tricky week for the government, and Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer was in Ukraine today.
It's very important that we ensure that Ukraine is in the strongest possible position. That's something I've been arguing for since I've been Prime Minister. This is my seventh meeting with President Zelensky. I'm here at the burns unit of one of the Kiev hospitals, which is a grim reminder of the heavy price that Ukraine is paying.
The Prime Minister said the UK would never let up on giving the necessary support to Ukraine as he signed what Downing Street has called a landmark 100-year partnership pact with Ukraine. Today is a truly historic day. Our relationship is closer than ever, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told reporters after the signing. The agreement formalises economic and military support already pledged to the country. But critics have called Starmer's visit a smokescreen following a difficult week where his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, was on the end of calls to resign after UK government borrowing hit a 16-year high. Inflation and borrowing costs have since dropped in a surprise reprieve for the Chancellor, but questions are still being asked about lower than expected UK economic growth of just 0.1% in November. Alicia, let's just start with Ukraine and then we'll move on to the broader issues that the government's been dealing with. How significant is this particular agreement with Zelensky this week?
I mean, to sign a treaty to say that you will basically be in a pact where you promise to give all the support you possibly can for 100 years, so long before this war ends, obviously, we hope, that is huge. That's a really, really big commitment from the UK there. I mean, we know that the UK and Ukraine have built a really, really strong relationship over the past few years, but that is really definitely Keir Starmer signalling that he is willing to go above and beyond, that this isn't something that was just a conservative political point score, and that he actually is really invested in helping the country long after the war is over. So definitely a really significant move. I think also it's interesting, especially as Donald Trump has been putting a lot of pressure on other allies and NATO nations to actually step up their aid to Ukraine. He has basically said that when he's in power, it can't all be the US. You can't just rely on the US for everything. So I think that pressure there from Trump has definitely been felt amongst NATO countries and other European allies of Ukraine, and may have had an influence here in Keir Starmer's decision.
And obviously this was something that Boris Johnson was actually accused of quite a lot during his government, which was that when things got tough, he would jet off to Ukraine and have a photo op with Zelensky. Do you think that is a fair criticism to levy at Starmer this time? I mean, it's been a tricky week, and there he is shaking hands with Zelensky.
Do you know, I often think, and regardless of the party, I think that this is often an unfair political attack. I thought it was unfair the other week when everyone was annoyed at Rachel Reeves for going to China to try and make some kind of business deals there. I thought it was unfair a lot of the times when people said that of Boris Johnson. I do think that people underestimate just how important it is for our prime ministers to meet with people abroad, especially when there's a conflict as serious as the one happening now. So I do think that it's potentially an unfair criticism. I do think, though, timing, it hasn't been Keir Starmer's best strength, I guess, since he's entered Parliament. I mean, the comms have sometimes been a little bit off, and the picture opportunities and all those things. So I do think could do with some work, but in this instance, I wouldn't say it was particularly a fair attack.
And you mentioned Rachel Reeves there. I mean, at the beginning of this week, if you read the papers, you'd believe that she was on the brink of being sacked because of the rising cost of government debt. Actually, something that was pretty much out of her control and has now dropped. So it seems that she's probably off the hook for a little while. What did you make of all the attacks on Rachel Reeves earlier this week? Do you think they were justified?
I mean, look, if you're Chancellor and the economy's in a bad way, you're always going to get the flak for it. And that has been true for everyone, fair or unfair. It's always going to be the way it is. I think what is understandable are the attacks on the economy. Of course, people are going to be angry. People don't feel like they can afford their daily life. And sadly, she is the face of the economy. But as I just said, with that trip to China, for example, I think that's where it gets a little bit much and a little bit too extreme. I do think as well, this Rachel Reeves being sacked story has also been a slight issue with messaging and Labour messaging and kind of staying online, because Keir Starmer, when asked whether or not she would remain Chancellor until the end of the Parliament, at first kind of refused to say. He said she's got his confidence and that she's really good, but he wouldn't quite commit to that. And then just a few hours later, after all the papers had written the story saying that Keir Starmer has no confidence, he then came forward and said, oh, no, she definitely will. She will be there to the end. And by doing that, it, one, kind of made him look slightly indecisive and unsure. And then secondly, has now put him, ring-fenced him, I guess, into keeping her until the very end, or he gets accused of doing a U-turn. So a little bit of a messaging issue, I think, there from Labour.
OK, and just before we move on to something across the Atlantic, today Labour have announced nationally backed local inquiries into grooming gangs. So this is £5 million in government funds to back inquiries modelled on one that was done in Telford on the grooming gang scandal there. Do you think Labour have caved to pressure from the right and from right-wing media over this? Or do you think this was the right thing for them to do?
I mean, the message and the line from Labour changed really rapidly. So obviously, when this whole row started, it was because Jess Phillips had said, oh, there is no need for this government-led inquiry. They should do it via local councils. And then pretty much as soon as this all exploded, the line quickly changed to actually, if the victims want this inquiry to be government-led, then that's what we'll do. We want it to be up to the victims and nothing else, really. So I don't know. I don't know what the conversations have been between victims and the government. I'm unsure of that. But it does seem like this whole row has massively influenced Labour's stance on this and definitely softened their point of view. And I think the question still stands. It's whether it will actually make a difference to have a government-led inquiry versus a council-led inquiry. I mean, I personally can't tell that there would be a huge difference between the two as long as we find out where the wrongdoings are and the changes are implemented. I think that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. OK, let's cross the Atlantic, where the US will have a new president on Monday.
What motivates you to keep going?
Who the hell knows? I don't know. I just want to be with people like this. There's so much love in this room. So much love, right? Isn't it amazing? No, it's pretty easy. I could have a lot of different, I have a lot of alternatives. I could be in a beautiful beach with the waves hitting me in the face and all that boring stuff. And I've been there. And you get very bored pretty easily. I have one thing in mind. It's called Make America Great Again. That's all I think about.
There he is, the dulcet tones of Donald Trump, who will move back into the White House on Monday after he officially became the 47th president of the United States. Inauguration Day includes a formal swearing-in ceremony as well as musical performances, a celebratory parade and a number of formal balls. Vice President-elect J.D. Vance will also take the oath of office, joining Trump on the stage to officially begin their new administration. Trump and his Republican Party have an ambitious agenda and control of the U.S. Congress, as well as a significant 6-3 majority in the U.S. Supreme Court. In layman's terms, that means Trump and his party have control over all major lawmaking branches of the US system of government. Scary stuff. In the next 4 years, we can expect strong policies on immigration, deregulation, and decisions to be made about supporting foreign conflicts abroad, as well as the influence of the world's richest man and big fan of this podcast, Elon Musk, to be front and centre. The list is endless, and the world stands and waits to see what Trump, as the most powerful man on earth, might do next. Alicia, what do you think we can expect from the first few weeks of Donald Trump?
Well, I thought you were going to say, what can we expect for the inauguration? I was going to say just pure chaos.
Yes.
Because he literally got rid of every single protocol that you can ever imagine for these things. I mean, I don't think Keir Starmer's invited, which is just insane when you think about it. Anyway, first few weeks, I think, will mainly just be about Trump trying to assert himself. It is his time to prove to everyone that he's back, that he's better, he's bigger than last time, and that he's kind of got a grip on the US. And I think that will be the key thing. I think he's going to talk a lot about Russia and Ukraine. I think he's going to throw a lot of that around and say that he can end that conflict, which he has been saying for some time. But I do think the first few weeks are really going to be all about just him as a person, what he stands for, and just kind of the MAGA movement amplifying that and kind of setting the tone, I guess, for the next few years. I think it was interesting, his inauguration, he's invited the TikTok CEO, I think, which is interesting when they're considering banning it in the next weeks. So I'm not quite sure what's going to go on there. But yeah, I think we can expect a lot of noise from the US in the next couple of weeks.
What sort of policy areas do you think Trump is going to focus on at first? I mean, he's spoken a lot about immigration, particularly. He wants to sign an executive order to secure the southern border. He's spoken about pardoning people who were convicted for the January the 6th insurrection. He's spoken a lot about Ukraine. He said he could end the war in Ukraine in a day. And of course, all these threats about tariffs and the economy. Perhaps he will invade Greenland. I mean, what exactly do you think he is going to focus his policies on in his first few weeks?
You know what? I think if I had the answer to that, I would be so rich, because literally no one knows what Trump's going to do from one day to another. That's kind of what makes him himself, isn't it? I mean, he says one thing and then the next day it might be something totally different, and no one kind of has the right to be shocked, because that's just how he rolls. I do think that kind of culture war issues are going to be really big for him this time round. Actually, I saw a really interesting article, I think it was in the FT today or a couple of days ago, about lots of bankers in the US and kind of finance people saying that they are really happy that they can kind of use inappropriate language again now that Trump is back in office. That was kind of their main thing. And I think that really sums up an issue that Trump is going to amplify. It's going to be, you know, free speech. You can, anything goes, anything I say, you can say too, kind of thing. And I think that will dominate for a while.
Priorities. Okie doke. Well, that was the week unwrapped. Thank you so much, Alicia, for joining me this week. Coming up, should the UK seek closer economic ties with the EU? Well, Lib Dem leader, Ed Davey, remember him, has been speaking, and he thinks the government should request to rejoin the UK customs union to bring economic growth to the nation. But is he right, or has that ship sailed? That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the Faye, truth. Faye. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SAS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, with the economy in the stagnant state that it is in, should the UK look to economically realign itself with the EU?
The UK must be far more positive, far more ambitious, and act with far more urgency. That is why today I'm calling on the government to negotiate this year a brand new deal with the EU. Not just tinkering around the edges of the botched deal the Conservatives signed 4 years ago, but negotiating a better deal for Britain that has at its heart a new UK-EU customs union to come into force by 2030 at the latest.
So, the UK should negotiate a new customs union deal with the European Union. That's according to Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey, who we just heard from there. In a speech in London, he argued it was needed to boost Britain's economy and its ability to deal with the incoming Donald Trump presidency from a position of strength. A Lib Dem spokesperson said the move was a practical move to turbocharge the economy and a step towards the eventual Lib Dem goal of rejoining the European Union. Sir Ed also warned that Trump could not be relied on to play by the rules or to stick to international agreements. While elsewhere, Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch, in a speech today, has singled out, amongst other things, the decision to pursue Brexit without an economic plan for growth outside the EU as a reason the Conservatives lost last year's election so badly. So is it time to rejoin the EU customs union, or should we be using our so-called Brexit benefits to agree trade deals elsewhere, given there is also low economic growth in the European Union? Well, joining us on the programme to discuss this is Peter Wilding, author of the book What Next? Britain's Future in Europe, and the man who coined the word Brexit. Peter, thank you so much for joining me today. Let's just get down to it. Does Ed Davey have a point?
Definitely. Brexit had two facets to it. If you were going to do it, you had a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit. We chose a hard Brexit, which meant we left the single market, which the United Kingdom created in the first place, and the customs union. And these two things are very important, because we're a market of 60 million people, and the European Union is a market of 600 million people. And if you're in the single market and the customs union, they're just one market. And we stopped that. We decided that we were going to put up trade barriers to our biggest market. And that's the deal that Ed Davey is talking about. We could have chosen a soft Brexit. We could have left the political institutions of the European Union, but stayed in the economic ones. The single market, no regulations within the 600 million consumer market. The customs union, which just allows collective deals to be done abroad. So, you know, Ed Davey, for goodness sake, this is the party that had a leader just before him, which wanted to revoke Brexit in the first place. And now, footling around the edges saying we must join the customs union just misses the point. If you want growth in the UK economy, which is stagnant, you either invest, which takes years, you deregulate, such as building, planning, which takes years, or you rejoin the single market and the customs union, you boost your growth immediately. And it's just so sad that the British political conversation, the elite, the establishment, members of parliament, just can't bring themselves to say it.
So in the UK, we've had, as you know, pretty stagnant growth. But the Eurozone hasn't exactly had excellent growth either. So GDP growth in the Eurozone was 0.4% in the third quarter of 2024, while the US, comparatively, it rose by 0.8%. Some people might say, actually, is there any point joining the EU if they're experiencing similar economic circumstances? I mean, what would you say to that? Are there still benefits we can gain from rejoining those institutions?
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. There's no question that France and Germany are doing, you know, no better than we're doing at the moment because of international reasons. But that's really not the point. There remains growth in these economies. We're just not part of it. £15 billion of exports have stopped because of Brexit. £100 billion worth of overall trade isn't there because of Brexit. The government has lost £40 billion. Almost the size of the defence budget in tax revenues because of Brexit. Stares you in the face. And it, the fact that this the British political debate just can't squarely look that in the face is amazing to me. I mean, the people in government know this. I mean, I worked with them in the Remain campaign nearly 10 years ago. I mean, they're not stupid. They know this. But they can't, they feel they can't say it. Because the debate in this country is so skewed. You know, the right-wing press will Brexit betrayed and the rest of it. Just stops an absolutely honest debate being taken about the bigger picture. I mean, you're bringing up things like customs unions, like that. But the bigger picture is we chose hard Brexit over soft Brexit. That deal, the hard Brexit, Boris Johnson's deal, comes up for review next year. So we have the ability to change it. But we're so fried in the lunacy of the debate that happened so many years ago now that we just can't act like a serious country and confront the fact that we are losing, you know, we are smaller, weaker and poorer country than we would have been had we stayed in the European Union.
And as well as Ed Davey calling for us to rejoin the customs union, Kemi Badenoch, who's leader of the Conservative Party, criticised former administrations for saying they would leave the European Union without having a plan for growth. Now, would it be fair to say that the reason there wasn't a plan for growth outside the EU is because there wouldn't have been a good plan for growth? And actually, the only way we could have left the European Union is with our hands tied behind our back, because for all the reasons you've just pointed out, really, our best prospects lie remaining part of that union.
Well, on your last point, particularly because Brexit was to say no to being restricted in Europe and yes to the globe and faster growing economies in a globalized world of free trade. I mean, you couldn't have picked a worse moment to decide on globalization and not your home market, Europe, than 2016. If globalization is now in free fall with Trump, China, regionalization, tariff barriers, you know, it couldn't have been a worse choice to leave the European Union because of the economic history that continued after it. And on the second point, sorry, can you just remind me of what you're...
So my question was, Kemi Badenoch talked about there was no plan for growth and they shouldn't have left without a plan for growth. Was it possible to have a good plan for growth?
Yes, thank you. Yes, there was. Mm. The problem was there were three options for growth with Brexit. You could have chosen the Boris Johnson plan, which was protectionist. Namely, we'd invest lots of money, kind of nationalism on steroids, lots of money in the north, we'd protect our markets, there would be growth, there'd be big business, etc. Then you had the Liz Truss variety, which was the Singapore on Thames, entrepreneurial, let's just cut taxes, cut regulations, and hope we had growth through investment. And then you had the managerial approach, the Theresa May approach, which was to stay in the single market customs union, such as it was in the deal that she has, at least be very close to it. And all these three options which were available were tried by three different prime ministers and they all failed. And the reason for that is because, I mean, having been in the Conservative Party since 1979, I'm sad to say, and also having been central to this European debate in the Conservative Party, you know, since the 90s, it was all driven by emotion and not by fact. There was a desperate desire to recreate conservatism, first of all, as a kind of nationalist project out of Europe, and secondly, as a kind of Anglosphere, the Commonwealth, the United States, Canada. We're not European. The old white Commonwealth, if you like, was on. I mean, all these fantasies were, you know, perpetrated by people like Dan Hannan. You know, Oxford graduates of great esteem, but they had a completely obsessive view that Europe was a bad thing. And this is the result of it.
That's really interesting. I mean, with the rise of far-right nationalist parties across Europe, but also here in the UK, we know we see Reform gaining support, for example. Do you think we've missed the moment for somebody to make the case for rejoining the EU? Because as you say, this was a sort of emotive, almost nationalist project. If you have rising levels of nationalism, is there any convincing case you can make that the public will get on board with for rejoining the EU?
Well, I mean, that is a really good question, and I think it hits the nail on the head. There was a photograph in the papers a couple of days ago, all the great liberal leaders at the G7 summit 10 years ago, when the liberal international rules-based order, globalization, the thing that we created after the Second World War, you know, was a hegemonic idea. Everybody agreed with it. Brexit, Trump, nationalism, the rise of China, the rise of Russia, war, have totally destroyed the arc of history that we experienced after the collapse of the Soviet Union, in which our idea, liberal, international democracies, prevailed. You know, the end of history was predicted 30 years ago. And what's happened is leadership. Leadership has been trumped by new media. There are no Churchills now, because no Churchill would ever go into politics these days. Everybody who had experience in business would never go into politics these days. The turnover of people in the political establishment is so fast compared to where it was 40 years ago. You've got no institutional memory. People live by day to day. Their only concern is to be re-elected. The ship of state basically hasn't got a captain. And so your point, is it too late, is absolutely right. Because I'm afraid what's happening now is that globalization has lost its legitimacy. Nationalism in the form of Farage, Trump, Le Pen in France is much more attractive. And because governments don't have any money, and because people have no aspiration, people are turning on the system that we grew up in.
So what do we do then? If a rejoining of the EU looks bleak, the prospects of it look bleak, do we realign ourselves with the UK? Do we keep pushing, with the US, sorry, do we keep pushing this argument about joining the EU? Or do we try and, you know, embrace the sort of nationalist feeling and, you know, maybe become more protectionist? What do we do to survive in this modern time?
Well, another brilliant question, because really that choice is going to be made for us rather than by us. Trump's decisions, when he comes into power next week, will determine how we must approach this. So let's say Trump goes full on tariffs, you know, really serious transactional, hard-headed politics with any ally. The UK is going to be in a exceptionally difficult position. 50% of its trade is with the Europe that it abandoned, right? All its defence and security policy is allied to the United States. It's always had this geostrategic problem. And ever since Thatcher and through Blair, it's been solved by the UK being what they called a bridge between the US and Europe. We were members of the European Union. We could kind of intermediate. That's gone. So we are now in a situation we're not in a situation we've been in for nearly 60 years now. Our choice is, do we choose... The choice is going to be determined by who the political and economic elite of the United Kingdom are. Finance capitalists would always associate with the United States. So that's the hedge funders, the fund of Conservative Party, etc., the media elite. Europe is all about economics, because it would be much better for our economy for a quick fire burst of growth to be back in the single market customs union. So how is this solved? Your answer to your question, leadership.
Oh, I think we might have just lost Peter, which was a shame. I wanted to know more about leadership. But that was Peter Wilding, author of the book, What's Next? Britain's Future.
And I'm afraid to say...
Oh, he's back. Sorry, Peter. Sorry, we lost you for a second. Please continue.
Sorry, yes. A little announcement has come up saying it's unstable.
You were talking about leadership.
Yeah, it's all down to leadership. A great Swiss historian once said, leading a country is like painting a work of art. The trouble with our political leaders is that they're colorblind. They have no vision beyond the next election or the short-term media cycle. I knew that when I was in number 10. There was no concept of vision. And that, I'm afraid, is the troubles position that we in the UK are in. We've got a competent leadership without vision, who are about to embark on the most unstable geopolitical environment that the UK has faced since, the 1950s.
Peter, thank you so much for your time today. That was Peter Wilding, author of the book What's Next? Britain's Future in Europe and the man who coined Brexit.
It's Ali Malani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. Foo Bar Radio.
Okay, coming up, are you work shy? I know I am. The co-founder of beer and pub chain BrewDog has said this week he thinks the UK is one of the world's least work-orientated countries. Well, is he right? And do we all need to work a little bit harder? All that and more next.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the truth. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my Yes I Yes sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
So I just think the whole concept of work-life balance was invented by people who hate the work that they do. So if you love what you do, you don't need work-life balance, you need work-life integration.
That was James Watt, the founder of beer and pub chain BrewDog, who has claimed Britain is among the world's most work-shy nations after he faced abuse for claiming employees did not need a work-life balance. Mr. Watt, who transformed his local craft beer company into a global phenomenon, branded the UK among the least work-orientated countries in the world and said that business leaders thought the UK's work ethic just doesn't stack up against other nations. The Scot had also provoked controversy earlier by claiming the whole concept of work-life balance was invented by people who hate what they do and that people should instead seek to achieve work-life integration. In a blog on LinkedIn about what he called a bizarre controversy, he asked what it said about British society that a post extolling the virtues of hard work gets messed with this kind of furious backlash. He said, as a nation, we love to joke about the French being lazy, but the reality is that our output per hour is 13% lower than theirs. And I've heard countless international leaders say that the UK's work ethic just doesn't stack up against other nations, especially in the US. My eyes are rolling into the back of my head. Okay, joining us to discuss this and why the UK is falling behind in terms of productivity is Stefan Stern, the author, columnist for the Financial Times and co-presenter of the Nowhere Office podcast. Thank you for joining us. Okay, is James Watt right? Are we a work-shy nation?
Oh, I think he's more or less completely wrong, but he's got there through an interesting look at the productivity figures and the output per capita, which are worrying. Productivity in the UK has been terrifically low, flat, unexciting for almost two decades now. So have wages as a result of that poor productivity performance. So he has spotted the problem. I think, though, he's come up with really completely the wrong analysis of it.
So let's talk about that, because he's basically linking work ethic to productivity, but perhaps you can dispel that a little bit for our listeners.
Yes, productivity, the value of what we do at work and how work is organised. Now, this is not necessarily, of course, in the worker's gift. There are these people called bosses, managers, business leaders, chief executives, as Mr. Watt was until recently. We'll come back to that in a minute. Workers are really not necessarily in charge of how their work is organised, the targets they're set, the skills and training and development they're given, the morale that they're encouraged to have or not, the ethos and spirit of a business or organisation. These aren't actually in the control or the gift of the workforce. If we're worried about chronic low productivity, and we should be, and the underperformance of what is sometimes called the long tail of British businesses, we really have to look a bit higher up the hierarchy of the organisation and ask ourselves, what's going wrong at the top and in the senior management in particular, perhaps lower down, but particularly at the top, what's going wrong in this organisation that productivity remains quite so low? I wouldn't really blame the workforce and alleged poor work ethic. I think people like to turn up to work. I think they like to do a good job. They want to get fairly paid for it. They want to feel good about what they're doing. I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is probably higher up.
You mentioned their pay, which is obviously a big issue, because there has been a fall in real wages since the start of the recession, which was triggered by the financial crisis in 2008. As you know, the real wages has fallen, and I think they're about around or even before the sort of level of 2007. And of course, the other issue is that we have increasing costs. So house prices, I think, are about 8 times the average earnings, perhaps even more than that. I'm sure you correct me if I've got that figure wrong. And so, you know, people are making relatively less money, and then they are struggling to get on things like the housing ladder, struggling to afford perhaps the luxuries they used to. Do you think this impacts our productivity, or perhaps this does impact people's work ethic, and maybe that's fair enough?
Well, look, I think the other thing we should chuck into the conversation as well is all the important point you just made is the COVID experience, lockdown, working from home, hybrid working and so on. We've been through a hell of a lot, both economically and psychologically. And I think we're still coming out of that, frankly. We're still trying to work out how best to work. And you can see that also, that other row that's brewing between bosses who want to see people physically back in the office full time, back in the workplace full time, if possible. And others who are saying, a lot of the workers are saying, well, actually, you know, I've had this experiment. It actually worked quite well for me. I've saved a lot of money on commuting and on work clothes and expensive sandwiches and all that sort of thing. Could I still keep some of this flexibility that I've actually enjoyed having and by the way, have delivered on all my deadlines and targets that you set me? So this is all part of the mix. I think, yes, people are concerned that their wages are not rising and that they're not getting what they might regard as a fair reward. And that clearly would be demotivating. I don't think that actually necessarily undermines the concept of work ethic, but I can see why morale would be struggling. Of course, in the political sphere, we've seen how people have been protesting, ejecting incumbent governments and voting for sometimes apparently simple solutions to complicated problems, which we might include Brexit in as well.
One thing that the Labour government is attempting to push through is their workforce reforms, where they want to a number of things. They want fair pay in certain occupations. They want kind of enhanced rights for employees. I mean, there's a whole raft of things in there. Do you think this might go some way to improving the UK's productivity problems, or does it go beyond this?
Well, there is this concept of the precarious workforce, the gig workers, the people on 0 hours contracts and so on, many who feel unsettled, perhaps hard to plan for the future, hard to plan financially for some of those big commitments that you were referring to a moment ago. So, yes, I think a bit more security and a bit more genuine flexibility for workers, that could be a good thing. Of course, it's getting criticism from both sides. The CBI and other employer organisations are nervous about some of these changes. I have to say, on the left, there's quite some dissatisfaction too about what was originally being discussed in the Labour Party manifestos in 2017 and 19 and what's going to emerge in this employment rights bill. Not quite as perhaps as deep and radical as was being talked about before. So that's the task the government's got to steer, got to find a place where employers and employees can agree. But yeah, I don't see that a more civilised and a more secure workplace in that sense is going to harm workers' output. I'd think, on the whole, I'd think that would provide a sort of reassurance and a floor, if you like, for standards and treatment and wages as well. Where, I think that's going to be an encouragement to output, not going to be a deterrent to it.
One thing that raised my eyebrows quite a lot there were plenty of things actually in James Watt's comments, but one particularly was him saying, I think the whole concept of work-life balance was invented by people who hate the work they do. If you do what you love, you don't need work-life balance. I mean, there's lots of things I could say about this, but I want to get your view on this idea that, you know, people should love what they do. Do you think that's a slightly kind of almost privileged thing to say? Because there are plenty of jobs, you know, that people undertake because they have to and don't necessarily feel wedded to that work. I mean, is that quite an outdated view that he's putting forward that doesn't necessarily meet up with the lived experiences of people in this country?
Well, I mean, the thing I wanted to get back to is actually that James Watt himself stepped aside from being a full-time CEO, and he said he wanted to spend more time with his family and travelling and so on. So the idea that work-life balance was an alien concept to him seems a little bit odd. But no, I think there is an interesting discussion about meaning at work and fulfilment. Of course, some people just are working to pay the bills and keep the roof over their head and so on, and that's totally legitimate. And we could be a little bit too grand sometimes when we say that every day at work is going to be profoundly meaningful or a revelatory experience. And of course, that's not going to be the case. Providing good service, however, and doing a good job and finishing a shift and feeling that you've made a decent contribution and collaborated with colleagues in some sort of common purpose, common endeavour, I think that's not a grand notion. I think that's quite an important one, quite a meaningful one. And we all know as customers, when we go to businesses, where we're well served and well looked after, where a good service is provided at a fair price and we don't feel ripped off. We feel that something valuable has been offered to us and it's been worth what we've paid for it. And I think workers are the same too. When they're not being consumers, they're employees and they want to feel they're doing something that's pretty worthwhile. So no, it doesn't have to be a shattering philosophical revelation every day, but you should feel good about work when you finished it.
And I want to put something to you that I got slightly kind of laughed off Blue Sky for suggesting the other day, and I was being a bit trite about it, but one of the things that I've found and one of the things that research does stack up with as well, and that, you know, everybody knows anecdotally, is one of the things that make people very unhappy and unproductive at work is their managers. And one of the suggestions I made was, what if every manager in this country had to have compulsory management training? Would that improve our productivity? What do you think of that? Is that just total nonsense?
Not at all. But actually, what has gone wrong in terms of executive development and so on is that so much of the money has been spent at the very top. In fact, we even hear stories about how the apprenticeship levy has been gamed to provide, you know, masters and other high-level qualifications for people who are already doing well. No, this long underperforming tail of companies that I referred to earlier, this is absolutely down to bad management and managers who do not take their job seriously enough or are not able to take their job seriously enough. And there's quite a lot of research into this that came out of the LSE by profs John Van Reenen and Nick Bloom and others that showed that the British cadre of management, if you like, is underperforming. Because we know what good management is. It's not actually that complicated. It's partly about being a decent, alert, attentive human being. Yes, making demands, indeed, but being ambitious, but also treating people like decent human beings and having an interest in the people you're managing. This is not actually an obscure or mysterious task. It shouldn't be beyond us. Sometimes the culture of the organisation drags us down. Mm. But no, you're absolutely right. Taking management more seriously, it's not a cool subject, perhaps, for most people. Not very exciting. We like to blame management for things. Mm. But actually, taking management a bit more seriously, as they do in some other countries with high productivity, which Mr. Watt alluded to, perhaps that would be a good thing.
Mm. Okay, well, listen, Stefan, I could talk to you about that all day because I find it really, really interesting. But I really appreciate your time. Thank you. That was Stefan Stern, the author, columnist for the Financial Times and co-presenter of the Nowhere Office podcast.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Well, that is it from Politics Uncensored today. Thank you for joining me and putting up with me without our lovely co-host, Ali Milani. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. And of course, you can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald on Blue Sky or Instagram. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FubarRadio.com or, of course, on the Fubar Radio app. Download it from your app store now. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.